Good afternoon. This is Richmond Independent Radio News for Friday, August 19th, 2005. I'm Lauren Ball. This week, we'll tell you about the concerns that several activists and advocacy groups have about the Supreme Court nomination process.
It's critical that the Senate takes very seriously its constitutional role of advice and consent in this case, not just rubber stamp to justice.
And in a special report, we'll go to the Gaza Strip to hear from Richmond Rabbi Zvi Ron about the current state of Israeli disengagement.
Everybody on both sides of the issue within the Israeli society wants to make sure that this will not tear the nation apart.
Those stories coming up after these headlines.
For WRAR News, I'm Matt Beckwith. On Saturday, August 20th, at midnight, the Richmond Police Department will initiate its new sector policing program, which was first announced in April of this year. The program, which is a project of Richmond's new police chief, Rodney Monroe, involves a reconfiguration of the previous precinct system into four precincts, which are broken into 12 sectors. The sectors are designed to bring policing to a neighborhood level, as opposed to the former conditions in which precincts covered a large area with many neighborhoods. In a press release issued this morning, Chief Monroe stated, quote, "Ultimately, this is going to lead to more visibility and accountability in the community." In an interview given last month, 3rd District Councilman Chris Hilbert echoed that sentiment.
I think it builds trust on the side of the residents because they see the police not just when someone is shot or when someone is being arrested, but day in and day out, and there's a trust factor that's created by that relationship.
The new system also calls for a change in the schedules of officers who will now be working permanent shifts with permanent days off. The program, which goes into effect as Richmond's murder rate stands at 61 for the year thus far, aims to involve the community in the crime-fighting process and give the police force a greater understanding of the specific areas to which they are now assigned. Councilman Hilbert, whose district has seen a large number of violent crimes and homicides, including the most recent Richmond murder on Thursday, has called for a town meeting in his district on Wednesday, August 24th, at the Police Academy. Present at this meeting will be the 2nd Sector Lieutenant Timothy Morley and Assistant Police Chief Ray Tarasovic. This will be the first town hall meeting under the new sector policing system. Mosquito bites are an accepted nuisance during the hot evenings of Richmond summers. Mosquitoes, while annoying, may also be potentially dangerous as they can carry West Nile virus. While the threat of infection is possible, simple precautions can be taken to ensure your health and continued outdoor enjoyment. WRAR's Amanda James has more.
Perhaps it is that we've become desensitized to the possible threat of West Nile virus. People tend to complain about the pesky and irritating bites mosquitoes leave behind, rather than the possibility that they may have been infected with a potentially deadly virus. West Nile virus is carried and passed through infected mosquitoes. The mosquitoes contract the virus through biting an infected bird. In the virus's worst form, it can cause encephalitis, or inflammation of the brain in humans. A mosquito can contract the virus from a bird and can therefore pass it on to a human, but the virus cannot be transmitted from bird to bird or human to human. This year, thus far, 14 other states have reported West Nile infection in horses, birds, and mosquitoes. Kansas has been the first state to report West Nile activity in humans, but the infection did not result in death. Recently, Richmond City Health Department officials have reported that within Richmond City limits, more birds have tested positive for West Nile than in any other city or county in the state. George Jones, Health Promotion Director for the Richmond City Health Department, could only offer a speculative theory about why there are such high numbers of infected birds found within the city limits. A plausible theory is that some birds are habitual roosting, meaning that they return to the same general area to lay their eggs. Common city birds, such as crows, hawks, owls, and blue jays, tend to be more susceptible to the virus than other species. This year, thus far, there have been no reported cases of human infection in Virginia. And Mr. Jones credits this to health department initiatives in educating the public as to what preventative measures they can take.
The biggest preventative measure that citizens can take is to reduce or eliminate any breeding habits for the mosquitoes. If we keep those populations down, then there's less likelihood that we will have mosquitoes that can contract the virus. There'll be fewer numbers to transmit the virus to us.
In addition to eliminating any stagnant water around the home, health officials also promote the use of insect repellents, such as DEET, and repellents containing picaridin and oil of lemon eucalyptus as effective preventative measures. Mr. Jones also suggested wearing more protective clothing when outside during dawn and dusk hours when mosquitoes tend to be more active.
By the public being more aware and taking those precautions, significantly reduce the likelihood and the probability of an infection occurring.
While mosquitoes carry the possibility of a potentially harmful disease, by taking simple preventative measures, we can still enjoy these beautiful summer nights without the risk of irritating mosquito bites and therefore possible West Nile. For WRIR News in Richmond, this is Amanda James.
On Thursday night, a feature-length Emmy-nominated documentary about Sudanese refugees screened at the VCU Student Commons in Richmond. The film, entitled The Lost Boys of Sudan, follows two young Sudanese orphans to America. Approximately 80 Sudanese refugees are currently settled in the Richmond area, having escaped to the United States from their native land, which has been ravaged by civil war for 30 years. The most recent crisis in Darfur, Sudan, has left the region in a volatile and unprotected state, too dangerous for civilians to return to their homes. The film is currently on a 10-city U.S. tour in an effort to raise awareness of the situation in Darfur, to bring support to the refugees, and to spark community involvement on a local and global level. Megan Milan, the documentary's producer and director, along with John Schenck, explained the goal of showing the film on this present tour.
The purpose of the outreach tour is really to raise awareness and involvement on both a local and a global level. Local being letting people know that there are refugees in their community, possibly their neighbors or fellow students, and what is it that you can do? Because the thing I took away from the experience of making the film is that the most helpful thing anyone can do for a newcomer, an immigrant, refugee, or just a newcomer of any sort is just be a friend, be open to getting to know someone, and that can have a really tremendous impact locally.
Milan also hopes that the film will inspire Americans to speak out on behalf of the Sudanese still dealing with violence, civil war, and genocide in their own country.
There's a lot going on in Sudan, especially in the Darfur region now, that we all really need to raise our voice to and educate ourselves more about it, let our elected officials know that we care about another part of the world. And I think when you can let someone know that there are people in their community who have the same stories, that really brings the headlines home.
The film, which has already won an Independent Spirit Award, will be shown next in Nashville, Tennessee in September. This is WRIR News.
For WRIR News, I'm Lauren Ball. Final senatorial approval for Supreme Court nominee John Roberts appears imminent, but even in a conservative state like Virginia, there is still opposition among the people. On Thursday night, the organization Virginians for Mainstream Courts sponsored a conference at the University of Richmond to discuss the future of the United States Supreme Court. WRIR's Dustin Richardson reports.
The stately campus of the University of Richmond might seem like an unlikely place for a room full of progressives to convene, but some might say that Virginia is an unlikely place to find any progressives at all. The Commonwealth is usually seen by outsiders as a strictly red state, through and through. However, there is a surprisingly large and fast-growing movement towards progressivism, and it is that movement that has made Virginia somewhat of a battleground in the debate over Judge John Roberts' appointment to the Supreme Court. Roberts is expected to see full approval from most Republicans and full denial from most Democrats. But Virginia Senator John Warner is a moderate Republican, and could be a wild card in this debate. This gives progressive groups hope that, with their lobbying efforts, Warner may help block Roberts' approval. This prompted the national group People for the American Way and Virginians for Mainstream Courts to host a forum for local progressive organizations to express their views on why John Roberts should not be appointed. Attendees included representatives from the Sierra Club, Planned Parenthood, and Equality of Virginia, an organization devoted to gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender civil rights. Also present were Rabbi Merrill Shapiro from the Congregation Or Atid and University of Richmond Law Professor Hank Chambers. While the agenda for the forum was clear, each organization's reasoning for opposing the nomination was unique, stemming from their group's area of concern. Glenn Beso was the representative from the Virginia chapter of the Sierra Club.
A lot of times people tend to not understand fully, you know, what's at risk for the environment. Obviously, a lot of the folks here are concerned with issues related to human rights, but certainly a clean, healthy environment is a human right as well. It's guaranteed, supposedly, under the Virginia State Constitution.
Diana Mason from Equality of Virginia explained that her organization would simply like to know more about Roberts.
It's critical that the Senate takes very seriously its constitutional role of advice and consent in this thing, to not just rubber stamp the justice, the judge, but to make sure that the questions are asked, that the country gets to see what type of person we're about ready to put on this court.
Her opinions were echoed by Professor Chambers, who felt that the Bush administration's refusal to release key documents from Robertson's past will limit the Senate's ability to make an accurate decision on his appointment.
If a nominee declines to say what he believes in a confirmation hearing, and many of the nominee's writings about his views are shielded from view, senators must advise and consent with blinders on.
The documents in question are from the time Roberts spent working in the U.S. Attorney General's office. They're being withheld under the argument of attorney-client privilege.
Now, Judge Roberts at the time was acting as an attorney and certainly had a client, namely the government. So, in fact, there's an attorney-client relationship, and in fact, there is a privilege. However, the privilege stops the attorney from divulging information. The client can reveal information that's involved. Indeed, it turns out that a number of the documents from Judge Roberts' work in the Reagan administration probably also subject to an attorney-client privilege, but of course, this particular administration had no problem turning those documents over. So it seems to me that any argument that the attorney-client privilege stops the current administration from turning over the documents is in fact a red herring.
But Chambers warns not to be too hopeful.
If the president really wants this nominee or really wants to win with bipartisan support and thinks he needs to release documents to get his way, he will turn over just as many documents as he needs to win. If the president can get what he wants without turning over any additional documents, he's going to withhold them.
Rabbi Shapiro mostly focused on the consequences of a diminished separation of church and state and expressed outrage at Bush's choice of nominees.
I can be very greedy, but never so greedy that if I had my man in the White House and owned the executive branch of this government, and I had an overwhelming majority in both houses of Congress and owned the legislative branch of our government, would I ever be so greedy as to go after the judicial branch as well, so that I would have it all?
Becky Reed of Planned Parenthood spoke on how reproductive rights may be affected by a Supreme Court with a conservative majority.
There's been a lot of speculation about the overturn of Roe v. Wade, but just to reiterate that really the more present and real threat is the gutting of Roe.
And talk of criminalizing abortions prompted one audience member, retired Dr. James Kenley of Matthews County, to recount his experiences from before Roe v. Wade.
When I was a young physician, I had a botched abortion come into the emergency room where a woman who had taken her 13-year-old daughter to an abortionist. I will never forget the condition of that little girl. Also had a woman of means. She aborted herself with a hat pin. When I saw her, her temperature was 105. I rushed her to the hospital, and she didn't live. It's a very serious thing. Desperate people do desperate things.
While some pundits have remarked on how comparatively moderate Roberts is turning out to be on most issues, it seems that for these Virginians, and many more across the Commonwealth, his record of conservatism on the issues that they hold most dear is reason enough to lobby for his dismissal. For WRIR News, I'm Dustin Richardson on the campus of the University of Richmond.
This is WRIR News.
Ever notice how other radio stations think about music and news?
Sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear.
Ever wonder where their programming decisions are made?
We are controlling transmission.
At WRIR, we think the community should be a big part of the station. To find out how you can participate in creating the future of Richmond Independent Radio, log on to WRIR.org.
You are about to participate in a great adventure.
And if you like what you hear on the air, tell a friend.
Women and children are the fastest growing segment of the homeless population. The Daily Planet has served Richmond's homeless population for nearly 35 years, providing valuable medical, dental, vision, and mental health services. They also do case management and job training. More than 35% of the healthcare clinic's clients are now female. Want to know more about the Daily Planet and homelessness in Richmond and the United States? More information is available at www.dailyplanetva.org.
For WRAR News, I'm Lauren Ball. The disengagement of the Gaza Strip has dominated recent world news. This week, we hear from former Richmonder Rabbi Svi Roan, who has resided in the West Bank settlement of Neve Daniel since August of 2005. WRAR's Sarah Barrett spoke with him on Wednesday evening.
This past Sunday, many Jews fasted during a holiday known as the Ninth of Av. Historically, this has been a time of grave adversity and disaster for the Jewish people. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's plan for the disengagement of the Gaza Strip was set to take place on this ominous day. Upon realization, the date was pushed back one day so as not to coincide with the holiday which marks the beginning of a three-week mourning period. Yet it remains an emotionally charged time for the Israeli people. I spoke with Rabbi Svi Roan, formerly of Richmond's own Knesset Beth Israel Synagogue on Patterson Avenue.
Can you explain some of the history of how we got to this point?
The United Nations in 1948 decided on a partition plan. That would be to divide the area of land between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River into an area for Jewish people and an area for Arab people, two states in that area. Now, the problem is that when the State of Israel was declared on May 14, 1948, then the armies of six Arab countries invaded. In other words, they rejected the two-state plan, and their aim was to take the whole area over. This is when Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia attacked. The problem is that they lost, and the Jewish people won. So what came out was an area of land under Jewish control, which was greater than what the UN had originally delineated. Now, the Arab armies tried this kind of move again in 1967, and this is what is the Six-Day War. And again, the military operation failed from their perspective. And at this point, Israel now took over more area. They took the Golan Heights, was captured from Syria, the West Bank was captured from Jordan, and the Gaza Strip was captured from Egypt. So here we have Israel now increased in size. So in other words, from 1967, we have Israel is now holding on to these additional areas. Now, what happened was, in the 1970s, when they have the Camp David Accords and the meetings between Israeli Prime Minister Begin and the Egyptian leader Sadat, what they decided on was something called Land for Peace. Land for Peace was that some of the areas that were captured from 1967 would be given back to the country it was captured from in exchange for a peace treaty. And what happened was that there were Jewish settlements that were already in the Sinai area, which had been established between 1967 and 1979, and these places were dismantled. And the Jewish population, they were removed, and they had to move away from their homes, and their homes were destroyed. And this was, you could say, like a type of disengagement like we have now. The only difference is that at that point, the disengagement was part of a peace treaty with Egypt. This time, the disengagement is unilateral. It is not set up within the confines of a treaty with another party.
Can you explain the concept behind the disengagement?
Here's the thing. Basically, everybody wants peace, okay? All the Israeli people, they want peace with the Arab people here. Now, the question is, how is this going to be accomplished? So the whole question is, if you remove Jewish people from their homes in these, you know, settlement areas unilaterally, that means that the other side is not saying, okay, in exchange, we will do X, Y, and Z. So what's happening is you're taking a chance. The chance is you're saying, listen, we have no agreement, we have no nothing. We're going to move out of here. We're going to let you, we're going to pull our army out of here. You guys are now in charge of Gaza. Now, it's up to you to keep the peace here. It's up to you to make sure this doesn't become a haven for terrorists. It's up to you to make sure that people from here don't attack us in Israel. We're, you know, depending on you to do that. Now, there's no agreement or anything. This is basically giving a chance for the Palestinian Authority to demonstrate that they can, you know, run themselves, govern themselves, and that the whole place is not going to just turn into, you know, a huge, anarchic, chaotic, you know, terrorist breeding ground. It's going to stop some of the tension of, you know, Jews and Arabs running into each other and Israeli army and stuff running into each other. And it's going to then create a situation that maybe, you know, the Arab population will simmer down and they will, in their own interest, make sure that there is no terrorism happening also in Israel. So that's sort of the optimistic approach. It says, we'll give them a chance. It's a chance for peace. We're just going to do this ourselves, pull out, and then, you know, hopefully it'll work out and they'll be good about it too. The sort of pessimistic approach is, hey, listen, you can't just, you know, pull everybody out and not have any agreement or, you know, not have any kind of an understanding. And it's sort of the pessimistic approach is, hey, if you're doing this, if you're pulling the army and the Israeli, you know, the Jewish settlers out of here, then this place is just going to turn into chaos with absolutely no control. And there's going to be even more terrorism. So the question is really, this is sort of the main debate point. In other words, is this something productive or is this something non-productive? You know, the optimists say this is a chance for peace. The pessimists say what you're basically doing is giving in to terrorists. That's the question, whether this thing is a, let's say, good political move or not good political move.
What is going on right now? What is the sentiment there?
Everybody on both sides of the issue within the Israeli society wants to make sure that this will not tear the nation apart, that it will not tear the country apart. So everybody, in a sense, is sad about what's going on. I mean, it's a sad thing that people have to be removed from their homes, and it's a sad thing, you know, you have these kids there, and they're going to be relocated, and nobody knows where they're going to go to school next year and all that. So everybody on both sides is sad, and also everybody on both sides, let's say for the most part, does not want to have any sort of violence, any kind of altercations between the soldiers and the residents that they are removing. So people are trying to preserve a certain, let's say, standard of protest, you know, what is considered okay and what is considered not okay. Within the Israeli society, nobody's like jumping for joy. Hey, this is a great thing. It's like a sad thing. And, you know, the people who are pro say, okay, it's a sad thing. It's a difficult concession, but we have to make it.
What is the goal of coexistence?
Coexistence is the idea that Jewish people and Arab people should, you know, live side by side, like, let's say, ethnic groups in the United States live side by side and interact in a normal and friendly way. So, well, I don't know. For example, you know, my plumber is a Palestinian. And, like, you know, the guy who built the bookcases in my house is also Palestinian. And that is coexistence. Now, the thing is that there were some of the settlers in the Gaza Strip, some of the Jewish settlers turned to the Palestinian Authority and they said, listen, how about if we just stay here under your rule? So we won't be, you know, Israeli citizens, but this is our houses. We'll just stay here and we'll be, you know, we'll be part of your country. And the Palestinian Authority said that that would be okay by them, but that they would not be able to, let's say, vouch for the safety of any Jewish person who stays. So the problem with that whole idea is that it's basically saying that there is no possibility for coexistence, that really, you know, Jewish people cannot stay, you know, where, you know, the Arabs are in charge because, you know, they're just going to get killed, and it would be very dangerous for them to stay there. You know, the ideal, the original ideal of coexistence is, you know, can we all just get along, and you know, we'll all, you know, live side by side and do our thing and all that. And the idea of disengagement really sort of demonstrates that that is now something that is being abandoned, at least in certain segments of the country or certain segments of the population.
How are the two sides expressing themselves?
The anti-disengagement group has taken the color orange to be their symbol, and the pro-disengagement group has taken the color blue to be their symbol. So what you have is you know, either orange or blue ribbons, you know, and then people have tied onto their antennas of their cars or tied around their rear view mirror, you know, these ribbons to show, you know, what they, you know, agree or disagree with. There's a very high level of awareness, you know, political involvement, especially among, you know, young kids who are now off for the summer. You have like little 9 and 10 year old kids are totally familiar with all aspects of these debates. You have these little, you know, armbands like you have in the States, the Live Strong kind of things. You have these little, you know, little like rubber bracelets. You have the orange ones, and then I haven't seen, but I guess there's blue ones as well. And then you even have people that they tie to the antenna of their car an orange ribbon and a blue ribbon, and that is supposed to demonstrate that they say, listen, well, it demonstrates either one of two things. Either, you know, I really feel for those people who are being evacuated, and I feel sorry for them, but we've got to do it. Or it's like, I agree with the protest, and I'm an anti-disengagement person, but, you know, there can't be any violence as part of these protests. So it's kind of to show, you know, that we're all, in some fashion, on the same team. And this is also something that you definitely see, at least in the news reports that they show here, is that you have the people being evacuated crying, and the people evacuating them, the soldiers themselves are crying. It's like everybody's crying. And, you know, it's a horrible, you know, and tough thing to go through.
Well, what is your take on the motivation of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian Authority?
Say, my belief is that the Palestinian Authority, they want to make this work. They want to have a normal country where people go to work and people, you know, come home and hang around with their kids and watch TV and go to sleep, just like any place else on planet Earth. You know, I would say that the majority of the Palestinian population, you know, they just want to be like regular folks. The terrorist groups over there, like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, etc. The question is, does the Palestinian Authority have the clout and the ability to rein in those terrorist groups? You know, are they willing to, you know, to take the steps necessary to make that happen, to crack down on these groups? I don't know. I don't know. That's the mystery. That's the mystery right now. That's exactly what everybody's worried about. Up until now, the Israeli approach was we cannot really depend on the Palestinian Authority to control the terrorist elements within the Palestinian population. We need our army in Gaza to make sure that those guys don't do anything bad. The approach now is we're going to pull out our soldiers, we're going to pull out all of our people, and it's up to you guys, you Palestinian Authority guys, you take care of your own business. Listen, already they're talking in the media. They say, listen, worst comes to worst, they'll just send the Israeli troops back in. If it does turn into, you know, this chaotic terrorist paradise, then the Israeli army will have to move back in, and this whole experiment will be over.
How is the protest working?
There's sort of like a tacit agreement between the settlers and the soldiers, and it's like this. The settlers fundamentally say to the soldiers, we don't want to hurt anybody. And the soldiers basically say to the settlers, we don't want to hurt anybody either. And the settlers say, well, we're not leaving voluntarily. And the soldiers' position is, okay, well, then we have to remove you. So what happens is that there's like an agreement that there will not be violence perpetrated one person against the other, but they have to physically remove the settlers from point A to point B. In Israel, the army is what we call a people's army. You know, every man, when he's 18, gets drafted into the army. So it's not like, you know, so the people that you're dealing with, you know, if you're a kid, that's going to be you in a few years. And if you're an adult, you know, that was you a few years ago. And these are, you know, your cousins and your neighbors. You know, it's not like the army is, you know, like the man, you know, the bad guy. The army is you also. You know, it's all one group. The dragging out people physically is just considered part of the protest to say, listen, this is a nonviolent protest against what's happening. It's like a sit-in, you know, here's a sit-in. Do you want to drag me out? Drag me out. That's the way it goes. You know, they said yesterday that, you know, don't think that it's going to be over tomorrow. You know, the army said, you know, but it'll be over in, I don't know what, a week or something like that. You know, by then they'll have everybody out.
Currently, the evacuations have paused and will resume on Sunday. Only a few of the 21 settlements remain. For WRIR News, I'm Sarah Barrett.
This is WRIR News. That's it for this edition of Richmond Independent Radio News. I'm Lauren Ball. I'd like to thank all the volunteers who worked on this week's program: Sarah Barrett, Matt Beckwith, Kevin Bledsoe, Amanda James, and Dustin Richardson. If you'd like to comment on anything you've heard today, or if you'd like to volunteer, send an email to news@wrir.org. Archives of WRIR News can be found on our website at www.wrir.org. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.